Welcome to the Biota.org Interviews Podcast. This is part of the special series taken from the audio of the Biota 2 conference. Today's speaker is Chris Winter.
Oh, it's interesting, Digital Biota 1. I'm trying to remember what the message of my talk was and whether I tried to make it controversial or not. I do remember being one of the few industrialists at the time, which was controversial in its own right. But the gist of my message was I was really puzzled. We were trying to make artificial life. I've been playing around with AI and the like, and I couldn't see how we were ever going to evolve a really big system. I mean, could we actually do anything that was genuinely lifelike? Because all the efforts that we were making were leading to very small things, and even the most wonderfully smart and cute and cuddly-like creatures were still actually very small systems, and this bugs me a lot. How are we going to ratchet the complexity up to anything approaching the levels of life? And one of the big questions that came out from the discussions between the paleontologists and the computer scientists and the industrialists and everybody else was, we can't even do a flipping nematode worm, you know? And a nematode worm, of course, is a wonderful creature. It's got 331 neurons, a fairly small number, if it's male, and 335 if it's female, which many of you will realize is a proof that women are naturally brighter than men. And I look back recently and I was thinking, you know, I started my life as a biochemist because I wanted to understand what life was all about. And then I've moved on to try and build molecular computers, to try and take the ideas out of biology and build computers out of the very molecules of life itself. And at some point I emerged, in Larry's words, from the purple haze of the 60s, and I worked on holography and optical computing for a while. And then one day, as I was walking to work, one of my colleagues, who was soon to become my boss, Peter Cochran, picked me up in his car. We only used to have 2 minutes, as he occasionally drove me into work. And that 2 minutes that day, he said to me, "Chris, how small could you make an ant?" And that was about as long as we had in the car that day. So the next day I came back and I said, "I've got it, Peter. I can make it out of aluminium gallium arsenide, solar cell on the top, charge, flow, transfer, integrators all built in underneath, little receptors, lasers to talk to each other, 4 little piezoelectric legs, 2 millimeters square." Got out of the car. That was the end of that day's conversation. When you worked in BT, you need a good long-term memory. And about 5 days later, he picked me up and said, "Actually, Chris, I wanted to know how much code it would take to make an ant." And that was actually the foundation of the BT Artificial Life Group. That was one of its starting points. And it was not long after Chris Langton and the rest had started with A Life One, or A Life as it was then, the conference. It didn't achieve a number till later on. And what interests me was that in that time, it never once entered my brain that if you wanted to emulate life, you would do it in a digital computer. I mean, what an absurd idea! Only a computer scientist could possibly think that way. And, you know, for me, the question became, why digital biota anyway? You know, I'm interested in artificial life, and it doesn't seem to me that digital has got anything to do with the issue. Fortunately, the subtitle was devoted to the engineering of biologically inspired synthetic organisms, which meant that I could actually attend the conference for half of it anyway, the artificial biota bit. And what I want to try and do is I want to try and take my slightly odd view as a biochemist, as a different sort of computer scientist, as somebody like A Life, and suggest actually there are great advantages in taking all we've learned and thinking about a subtly different sort of machine to do artificial life in than the one we've been using so far. Now, I don't want to say in this talk that using a digital computer cannot lead to artificial life. What I'm more interested in is the fact that just because it's possible to emulate any machine that you care to name on a digital computer doesn't actually make it particularly practical or helpful. And that's going to be the major theme of this talk, you know, and it's this difference between the fact that something is theoretically possible and practical which actually really interests me. So I was going to have a wonderful slide which showed that the way we think about life, the way we think about brains, is very driven by the current philosophical way of thinking and mode of operation. Unfortunately, Larry produced a much better slide with all these examples on, including two I didn't have, wonderful flippant remarks about the purple haze of the 60s that stole everything. So instead of repeating that, we'll just try and take the lesson from Larry. Though I notice that whenever people look at life or whenever they look at the brain, they just take whatever the prevailing metaphor is and say, that's the answer, of course. Which is why the current answer is dynamic systems, ain't it? You know? Because it's the latest buzz in computer science. But let's just actually take a look at this and ask ourselves, you know, is the brain actually digital? You know, being a biochemist, this is fascinating to me because, you know, I watch the computer scientists and they come along and say, got an action spike there, look, that's a one. No action spike, that's a zero. Digital. The brain's digital, isn't it? Let's wrap that one up. All we've got to do now is write a neural network over here with nice functions like this, nice square integrators and the like, and I've got a neural network. Excuse me. Most of the pulses in the brain are not action potentials like this. They're action potentials that go a bit like this. And I actually asked one of the guys, I said, why do you think the signal like that is digital at all? He said, oh, that's just ringing modulation on the signal. You can ignore all that noisy stuff there. Now, the first thing you learn about biology is the moment you start ignoring something, you've probably thrown something rather important away. And as you look into the brain in more detail, you discover that there are whole parts of the brain that don't use action spikes at all. I find it very interesting to listen to Michael O'Shea from Sussex University, neuroscientist. He and I were talking about this, and I said, I don't believe this action spike stuff. It might even just be an artifact. It's one of those side effects you see as a result of all the chemicals sloshing around. The ion movements may be irrelevant, you know. They said, well, it's very interesting that in certain parts of the insect brain, you can poison it so that the action spikes aren't seen at all, and that part of the brain now works better. It's actually faster because the information is being transferred through electrostatic interactions, through the diffusion of chemicals, through all sorts of other mechanisms. And when you get down to it, the action spike is just one small part of a phenomenal number of mechanisms there. And some of the really interesting work coming out of this is things like the diffusion of gases is important. I mean, there's no way that these diffusion of gases look digital at all. In fact, it's really difficult. You have to fake it all to try and do it digitally. So it begins to say, well, is the brain digital? Is it actually a vast number of analog things? And it's just that if you go in and look at one particular time scale, because you're looking with a digital mindset, you're looking through one time window and you say, look, there's something a bit digital there. And it could be possible that when you go to just a 0-1, you actually make it almost impossible for your cells to emulate all the important parts of what is going on. And I don't see any evidence that the brain is digital. All I see evidence is that that's the way that people think about it because that's the machines they're used to using from outside. And this is very interesting because it's very, very similar to the great mistake that was made in molecular computers. Around about 1980, possibly a little earlier, molecular computers suddenly came to the fore. Silicon was going to run out. By the way, if you want an insider's view, anybody who ever bets that silicon technology is going to run out of power and something else is going to replace it, well, I'll place any amount of money against you because you're on a losing bet almost every time, but never mind. Everybody said, silicon is going to run out, molecular computers is the next answer. So let's go into biology, let's understand how molecules work, let's build a brain using molecular components. So the first thing they said was, that wasn't the line I was expecting. That's interesting. I wonder what the rest of this side say. So the idea of this game was that they were going to turn, they were going to actually take all these molecules and they were going to turn life digital, in preference to artificial life, of course, which is trying to bring digits to life. And that was exactly and precisely how they thought. Now I'm going to try and find out whether the next slide one says what I thought it was like. Oh, yes, it does. And what they actually said was, how are we going to make molecules that copy what we do in silicon? Well, the first thing we need is a semiconductor or a conductor. So we come along and we make polyacetylene and we say that that's a conductor. And that was a great idea, except for the fact that polyacetylene just broke down if it saw a sniff of oxygen or a touch of water vapor, which is a wee bit impractical, but never mind. They were great optimists. And they tried to make it into a semiconductor and they tried to dope it up and they tried to copy silicon. And do you know what they found out? It was a pile of crap. In fact, I gave a talk to NATO about the difference between black shoe polish and what people were trying to do. And They were trying to copy the very ideas from silicon straight across into the molecules. So the next thing they said was, let's try and use proteins. That's what biology does. Look, a protein is a logic circuit, isn't it? So what we'll do is we'll take these proteins and we'll make logic circuits by treating each protein as a sub-element of a logic circuit. Well, of course, proteins aren't logic circuits and it didn't work. The next thing they said was, mixing up their biochemistry a little bit, well, what enzymes really do is pattern matching, because, of course, if you're not doing logic, you're doing pattern matching. That's about the two ways computer scientists always think. And they said, look, what an enzyme does is it precisely and exactly recognizes patterns in the real world that the pattern matcher, and we can now build a massive pattern matcher out of this. And the subject died. Because what they attempted to do was take molecules and impose on the molecules a way of thinking that came from a completely different science. And it's actually very illustrative, the fact that they thought of enzymes in this way. Because they said, what enzymes do is they lock in. It's a key and lock mechanism. Yeah? And immediately you saw something very strange. What you saw was that they had this belief in molecules that they were static things. They were things that you caught in the X-ray diffraction pictures. They weren't actually horrible, noisy, wishy-washy things that kept pulsing around and changing their shape and flexing in and out. And they actually fundamentally misunderstood what was happening at the molecular level. And because they fundamentally misunderstood what was happening, when they tried to copy it into a new form of computing, they didn't get anything out of it at all. And I want to suggest, actually, that much of the time when we're working with digital computers, we fundamentally misunderstand what biology is all about, and we end up with things that will never get anywhere near the complexity of real biological systems. And around at that time, a chap called Michael Conrad started some interesting work. Michael comes from the molecular computing area. He doesn't seem to have been heard of at all amongst people who work in artificial life, or indeed in mainstream computer science. But Michael came up with a whole bunch of very interesting, and I call them pseudo-mathematical proofs. That is, they're not absolutely rigorous mathematical proofs of things, but they were very interesting because they implied there was a whole bunch of trade-offs between different computational domains. And there's a consequence of it. The trade-offs I want to discuss actually tell you that we have a problem with using digital computers. And the first one was a trade-off between the idea that a system was programmable and the idea that it could be evolved. And he went into great detail about the characteristics that made a system programmable. And I don't want to do it mathematically because much of the audience wouldn't necessarily either want or enjoy going through Conrad's arguments. What I want to try and do is picture it graphically. Just imagine you're a computer programmer and you're on a digital machine. You expect your program to give you an exact and precise answer. So when you decide a computer language, what you've got to do is make sure that any program you write that works gives you a precise answer. That means that most of the programs that you write can't possibly work at all. Because if they could, then either all programs you wrote more or less gave you the same answer, which sounds like a universal program and rather tricky thing to build, or it must mean they only give you approximate answers and be roughly right, but then you wouldn't know how to debug them and change them and modify them to get the answer. So when you have this space of computer programs you can write, the vast majority of them don't work at all. The vast majority of the possible programs you can run. And if you build a machine that is very easy to program in this fashion, then it must, by definition, most of the possible instantiations of that machine must be ones that don't really work. On the other hand, when you want to evolve something, what you've got to have is very gentle gradients that you can walk up gently to find towards final solutions. And therefore, you actually want a machine in which almost everything that you do works to some extent or another. It's a very different sort of design domain. And his argument was that there was a trade-off between the things that were really easy to program and the ones that were really easy to evolve. And this was fundamentally at a structural level in the way you built these machines. And he actually went on to argue that programmable computers, by their very nature, were actually computationally very inefficient. Most of the time, most of the resource from the machine would not be being used. In the contrast, you could actually get evolvable computers that were up to 50% of the maximum theoretical efficiency. And he argued that if you were to design a computer that you could evolve biologically, it would not be one that was anything like today's programmable one. And if you did build one that was easy to program, it would be extremely difficult to evolve it to come to a solution. Now, I put to you that all the evidence of artificial evolution today is that it is jolly difficult to evolve anything to come to a reasonable solution. Anything complex, we can only do little toy problems. I mean, what's the biggest gene string anybody's ever evolved? You know, if I said 10,000 bytes, I'd be jolly lucky. And yet that's a minuscule thing. So you're looking at something which says, no, there may be a fundamental problem. It may be possible to evolve something as big as a human being, but actually it's practically impossible on that machine. And what interested me later on was the realization that actually evolution is only one particular example of adaptability. If you want a machine that can adapt, that can learn, then one, a machine that you can highly control and program may well be architecturally very, very difficult. And yet these are the very features that we expect from life. Evolvability, adaptability. And it's reflected for me in a phrase that I hear from Jordan Pollock quite a lot in the States, that computers can only learn what they almost already know. Almost everything we do in current evolution in learning algorithms, all the difficult bit comes in representing the problem, building in, engineering in all the knowledge originally. The actual bit where it solves the problem is relatively trivial. The hard bit is the representation issue, because computers can hardly learn anything at the moment, and that is fundamental to the decisions you made in choosing that architecture. So let's back off that a little bit, and let's dive into a little bit of biology. You know, DNA, great stuff. This is fascinating me. Four bases, 64 possible triplet codons, code for a mere 20 amino acids, bit of many to one mapping there. Well, it is 3-to-1 mapping anyway. Well, that codes for, if you take the typical protein, to be about 300 amino acids, a mere 10 to 319 proteins, which of course is that wonderful, you know, explosion, look at this little bit of DNA, wonderful range of choice, isn't it? Fascinating work done a decade ago now on the structure of chemical space, effectively. Looked at a large number of all the proteins that existed and concluded that there were only, at the most, a set of about 1,000 different possible fold structures. And the fold in the protein is the active site where everything happens. So despite this apparent immense explosion in possibilities, actually, there are relatively few functional units that are mapped off that DNA. And those functional units are actually more similar than you imagine, because a real protein is doing all this flexing and bending stuff. And it's not this precise pattern matcher that we're so often sold. If it was, you wouldn't have half the drugs, either recreational or medical, that you've got now, because they work by the fact that the enzyme has been confused in its pattern matching. And in fact, as an enzyme gets confused, the rate of a reaction changes on its pattern matching. So what you've actually got is you've got this vast space of intermediate possibilities that maps through to a relatively small number of fuzzily defined, continuously shading one into another functional units at the end. And I haven't seen anything in the GAs and the like that I've ever seen that matches this. And it's very difficult, because the reason that it does this is all to do with the complex way it folds, and to do with the fact that the thermal noise bending and flexing those folds tends to make whole families of structures perform in a very similar way. And that thermal noise that is in there is really the key part of understanding analog. It means that each of those fold structures represents a whole functional domain that it can smoothly move across. And that's, again, very different sort of model and way of thinking of what's going on. So if you like, we've got digital data, but at one level, they're fuzzily functions. They're not clean, well-defined that they map onto. They're actually in an analog domain by the time you're actually running them. And another little thought on genes. Very simple question. What the hell is a gene? I know, sir, I was hoping Richard was actually going to be here, because I did like his definition of a gene in one of his books, which is that functional unit at the genetic level which persisted long enough to be identified as some sort of structure, which is very useful, because it got round the fact that the old model was a gene was mapped onto a protein, and then you discovered actually that wasn't true, because genes are split up into lots of little bits, and anyway, when it was put together, other proteins assembled it in different orders, and when it did that, it folded up, and no, there isn't just proteins aren't just in one state. We know that because they denature. If you take them out to 40 degrees C, there's lots of different possible states. They actually fold themselves up into a kinetically stable state, and the one they fold themselves up into actually depends on other proteins that are bonded at the time. So the expression of a gene depends on other proteins elsewhere, so that gene is actually a mix of all the other genes. And the really funny thing in biochemistry is whenever you try and look for a discrete, singular entity, it is never there. It's always filtering out in every direction. We're used to designing systems that have got characteristic times and lengths, like digital computers, you know, clocking themselves away at their 200 trillion times a second or whatever they're doing. But when you look in biochemistry, you find you can't find a characteristic time or length for something. And every time you look, you only do it because you put blinkers on. You actually put blinkers around it. And it's very interesting, you know, biology looks modular. There's the heart. That's a discrete organ, isn't it? Well, just try cutting a heart out and working out where it stops, you know? Because even as you try and carve out the connective tissue and say, well, that bit of muscle I claim is the heart, you've accidentally taken out the blood supply and the neurons, the integral parts of it, so you sort of try and add another bit in. And it's actually very difficult. Biology is the worst case of awful object-oriented programming you can ever get. It reaches right in at the very base level. I mean, I've just been castigating some people in CyberLife the way they wrote some code. You know, right in the base level and ripping out things right down in the machine code level in special hidden functions to do things. It's like, oh, God, blimey, biology. Great hairy cludge, to quote Maynard Smith. The only difference in that in programming is it works. And part of this comes about because we've got this real desire to classify things that makes it nice for us in digital computers. You know, the heart is a discrete entity, genes are discrete entities, and actually that ain't the case in biology. Everything merges one into another, and mechanisms overlap with each other. And if you, that tells you something very important, because if you isolate a single mechanism and pull it out, it becomes powerless. I think that the one thing that Steve and I agree on absolutely is that if you just take GAs out on their own, you might as well have saved yourself the effort because you've thrown away 98% of the power of the system. So yeah, biology doesn't equal any one mechanism any more than a car is the same as taking a piston out and pretending you can drive along the road on it. And again, you know, that's very interesting. So okay, what I'm trying to say is that actually most of biology works in a very complex analog domain where things smoothly transform one to another, where you have continuously variables. And then I step back and I try and look at what happens with genetic algorithms and the way things evolve. And we put these hypercubes down. Well, actually, what I like is somebody commented the other day that actually we navigate in 3D space. So you hear people talking and they say, well, what I'm actually, I don't want to get stuck on a hill here with these valleys around me because I've got to work out how to traverse the valley. And what are they thinking? They're thinking a three-dimensional map. But actually, they're not dealing with a three-dimensional map. They're dealing with an n-dimensional Boolean hypercube. And there are really peculiar features about the statistics of n-dimensional Boolean hypercubes. If you take 1,000 bits, so it represents 1,000-dimensional Boolean hypercube, what is the probability from any one point that there is a path which has no minimum whatsoever to reach the global optima? The answer is that you have to put in a phenomenal number of minima in order that all paths from a point do not, all paths from a point go to a local minima. In other words, in general, for a randomly generated Boolean hypercube, from any arbitrary point in it, there will always be a monotonically rising path to the optimum. Now, it's counterintuitive. It doesn't look anything like you imagine the three-dimensional space does. And you have to sit down and spend ages writing the statistics down to suddenly realize, my God, I need to fill about 30% of the cube space with minima in order to block every possible path. So in fact, you've always got routes to get to the global optima. It's just the problem is that actually finding them. It's not getting stuck in local minima at all. So then you come up with the idea of neutral networks which permeate this space. And when you're in a Boolean space, this is actually quite difficult because you actually have to say, well, there aren't many neutral nets which are all at exactly the same level. So I'm going to say, you know, it's like they're all fairly close to each other and there's a reasonable chance of hopping from one point to another. But when you actually go to an analog representation of this space and realize that the effect of the noise is to spread all these points out, you suddenly discover the vast majority of any search space is permeated by neutral networks. Because the thermal smearing means there's a vast number of pathways through this. So you actually find that there's a completely different possibility for evolving. It is much easier when you start adding non-state-based noise which after all only otherwise, state-based noise only otherwise increases the dimensionality of the hypercube. When you start adding non-state-based noise into the system in an analog fashion, it suddenly becomes much easier to evolve. And there's another feature of biological systems too. That is, an awful lot of them use a phenomenon that I've never seen written to any of their programs. They use what I call amplified noise. Evolution is a classic example. You get a mutation, the selection mechanism feeds back to amplify this small mutation and trap it very quickly into a large population. Secondary messengers, you get a very small signal comes through, you get a 10 to the 6 amplification, it suddenly thresholds off everything and it has... And we play with this all the time, actually, in physics. I'm a much maligned physicist who, of course, are still stuck in the Newtonian age. Lasers are a classical example of amplified noise. Reverse Zener diodes. I had two other examples that I've actually physically worked with myself, and I've temporarily forgotten now as I stand up here whittering. That's probably because I'm amplifying noise at the moment. And in fact, the famous question of why are there only one sort of amino acid, I have a tendency, despite being a biochemist, to conveniently forget it. I think we're all L amino acids, aren't we? And D is terribly toxic. Must be because I used to play with D amino acids if I forget it. I've actually seen physicists go out of their way to try and understand why you've only got one sort of amino acid. Whereas actually, if life was a relatively unlikely event, then... if something evolved, because of the nature of the chemical space, you're either going to be L or D. If something starts off evolving as L, it's rapidly going to absorb all the resources, amplify out of all measure, and you're only going to end up with one type of amino acid trapped in your system anyway. And it doesn't actually require a question of whether K is conserved in some peculiar nuclear reaction that I heard one physicist talking about to explain why there's only one sort of amino acid, because most biological processes amplify noise very quickly. And it's very interesting that, because that famous... Buridan's ass, which I thought went under a different philosophical name. Buridan's ass, or who had it up this morning? That actually in a biological system, the probability that the two piles of food are exactly and precisely identical is so vanishingly small that it's unbelievable, and therefore even the smallest amount of noise in most biological systems will be amplified, and it will switch immediately to one decision or the other. And the other night, I carried out a quick test on this, and I put a pile of Smarties down and pointed a dog at it and made them exactly the same colour and shape, and of course the dog went and ate both of them. Turing machines ignore physics. That was what they were designed for. So they pretend it wasn't there. Digital computers try and do the same. They try and pretend there's no physics there so that they can make themselves perfect entropy machines, which is all very well, but unfortunately they're grounded in the real world. The result of this is that the way a computer works is a highly ordered machine that actually makes transitions between highly ordered states, and the net result is it actually does very little computation for each transition it makes, whereas actually if you stick a machine right on the edge of chaos and make a transition between two highly disordered states, then by definition you're doing a lot more computation per step. But the real question is, why on earth would you want to program all that physics in to make artificial life when you can use it? And that's when we step back and say, what's an analog computer? Well, an analog computer is something where you're actually deliberately and directly exploiting the physics, and you don't have to try and program it in. And with that, you get an awful lot for free. For instance, you can represent nonlinear equations directly as the nonlinear equations in the circuits or whatever you're using your analog computer. This makes them much faster and much easier to solve. It's a relatively trivial proof. There's a whole bunch of NP hard problems on a digital machine that are actually linear solutions on an analog machine. Martin Gardner first wrote about those way back in the 1970s when I was but a wee teenager and read his articles regularly. You have a big trade-off. I'm speeding up here because I saw the time Steve had just told me. The big trade-off in using analog computers is that you can never tell whether your answer is going to be how accurate your answer is going to be. But on the other hand, on an analog computer, you always get a solution out in a given period of time. You just don't know how accurate it is, which is very interesting because it's a trade-off between accuracy and halting. But most evolutionary problems, what you want is something that is good enough, not something that is precisely right. You can also use it to represent equations for which we have no idea mathematically how you can solve them now. It certainly shrinks the size of a computer phenomenally. What's the main thing that most biological systems seem to do? Integrate signals over various times and various modes. How many transistors do we need to make an integrator? 10,000? I don't know. Quite a large number, isn't it? one capacitor, guys. How do you do variable time dependence on a digital computer? You take a whole series of snapshots. It's like running film, because your machine goes from state to state. So it's effectively a film, one stage after another. Variable time dependence, RC circuit, no trouble. Fascinating to me, the Koreans actually did this. They then built themselves a Uran chip to be an analog neural network. And it was brilliant. It really packed the number of components in. Potentially phenomenally powerful. They were Koreans, though. You know what they wanted to do with it? A hot-filled network. Which, to my mind, was really bizarre to choose something that was fundamentally digital and impose it on a an analog architecture. But it just goes to show how deep the digital thinking runs. The real problem for me is, what happens if life needs a certain minimum level of complexity and a certain minimum amount of dynamics to actually replicate it? We need a certain minimum computational power. If we need a certain minimum level of complexity, with a digital computer, you've got to hand program every single bit of non-linearity in your cloud to get that level of complexity. If you can actually go straight in and exploit the physics, you can do things directly that you couldn't possibly do if you were having to do it by hand. If there's one lesson for looking at biology very, very close, it's you transmit signals long distances in a near-digital mode. That's why the best action potentials are always studied in the motor neurons and the like. You transmit digitally. It's great for BT. Still digital transmission, guys, on optic fiber. You store information in a near-digital mode, like DNA. Not really digital. When you look at it closely, there's all sorts of things you can show in there at the molecular level that aren't really digital, but never mind, it's good enough for biologists. But every time you look at the brain and work out how it computes anything, it does it in a near-analog mode. Actually, it's a mixed analog-digital domain. It's very fascinating. And if there's one lesson you could learn from trying to learn from biology is, you know, let's go for a completely different sort of computer. Let's make it analog. Let's use throttling at various levels to try and control the complexity explosion you get. That's what cell boundaries do. That's what these mapping from 10 to 390 proteins back to 1,000 fold structures give you. They give you regular throttle points to try and maintain and control it. And the best example of all this that I know is Adrian Thompson's work on FPGA. Supposedly digital, but because the chip actually gives you access to the direct physics, what Adrian ended up with was an analog machine with a few digital characteristics in it. You could have done the same, actually, if you'd gone for EPACs, so electronically programmable analog circuits. You could actually have things that you attach on the back of your digital machine. Now, a digital machine actually acted as this store of DNA, but it was actually implemented on an analog machine, and you might finally start to get to the point, a living, dynamic, complex circuit exploiting the real physics in the world and actually get the complexity ratchet that we so desperately need if we're going to build really big systems. Because I leave with you as the last thought that I don't think we're any closer yet to building a nematode worm, and I don't see any of the big ideas coming out that lead me to believe that just using digital computers alone will give you a nematode worm. So in this morning's debate, I'm on the side of those sweet little turtles. Or tortoises. Sorry, tortoises! That was a binary flip of the wrong word. I am in the domain of the tortoises, because I think that actually we're going to have to start building blocks on the back of machines if we're going to evolve more powerfully and make real artificial life. Thank you very much. Hello, Aaron. Great, Bart. I like that. I'll go with that on my gravestone.
The other problem, like, if you look at the development of what happened, there has been huge progress, which means that we can now build programs of an order of that were just not possible with and we are now that and test the not given an
I'm running your sentence through my brain because it wasn't the ending that I was expecting it, Iron, for the question. Yeah. Okay. I actually didn't, and deliberately didn't, talk about the final slide because it actually reflects, to my mind, something that Tom Ray said. I actually believe that if you want to do evolution on a digital machine, you should not copy biology. I actually believe that you should think about whether there is a form of evolution which is actually suited for that particular machine. And I don't believe that copying evolution per se is going to be a very good idea at all. Running back about 15 minutes and then realising I've forgotten what I was about to say in reply to the rest of it, we also must bear in mind that even our most complex programs now are orders of magnitude away from the complexity that relatively simple insects have. If I apply measures that I've tried to do, where I try to measure the complexity of different systems, my problem is that we don't have a decent measure of complexity to compare these systems with. We've now got programs that are much larger than they used to be by writing in high-level languages, but actually the minimum description length of those programs is actually vastly smaller. What we've actually done is made them much larger to make them easier to engineer, but the amount of extra complexity they've added, well, Microsoft is not the only people who managed to inflate the size of their programs. It's very interesting. The amount of complexity that we've got in the system. I remember the first time I said to Steve, did you know a network management system, Steve, that's between 1 and 10 million lines of code? And he went, good God, what do they all do? And I think that's a fair enough reflection. When you look at the complexity of the problem that's being tackled by them, it's amazingly simple. So I would beware of saying we've actually ratcheted up the complexity. We've ratcheted up the size. We've ratcheted up the complicatedness of the programs. But whether we've ratcheted up the complexity a vast amount, I don't know. Because I haven't got a decent measure of complexity. And I think I would happily, over pints of beer, argue that we haven't substantially increased the complexity. We increased it, I say, 2, 3, possibly 4 orders of magnitude at the most, but not by the number that we actually need to get, which is much larger than that. Yeah, he's not chairing, so I'll take whoever. Stephen, yeah. They used to be used a great deal, up to the mid-1980s, in fact, in missile simulations and the like. Analog computers were preferred hands down to digital ones because they were so much faster at solving the complex nonlinear equations. Why would you want to program it? The purpose is, you build an analog computer because it's evolvable, not because it's programmable at all. So wire it up to one way of looking at it. Chemical computer. I mean, you used to wire them up, but I mean, with modern EPACs, you don't actually play with the direct figure wiring. Yeah, I mean, the FPGAs are a good example in which you go in for the FPGA and use your binary level code to alter the wiring harness of the FPGA. And what you're then doing is exploiting the parasitic currents and the field effects between the elements to get yourself access to the analog physics domain and save yourself having to try and program all that flaming physics in. So in many ways, and EPACs are much the same, you actually go in and you change the wiring diagram and leave exploring the space of the possible wiring diagrams to explore the space of the possible nonlinear interactions that you get, which in many ways is very analogous to using the space of possible DNA structures to explore the space of possible thermally controlled protein folding structures.
This podcast is covered by Creative Commons. If you use this podcast either in audio or text form, please include a link back to biota.org as the source of this podcast. I'm Tom Barbalay, and if you're interested in more artificial life-related stuff, please subscribe to the biota.org mailing list. Thank you very much for tuning into this podcast. Look forward to you tuning into the next podcast.